2018, and the time is 8:30. I now call the meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. Members Will Lucas contacted me and indicated that he will not be able to attend the meeting. He has the good fortune of having his son graduate from college today. And so he will now have a pay raise, I guess, because of that. So I move that we take a vote to either accept or deny this request. All in favor of excusing, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it, and the absence is excused. As another matter, I've been contacted by Matt Moore, who has resigned from the commission, effective immediately, and so he will not be here today. And the governor's appointments office will be filling that spot, I believe, relatively soon. So we will have him. But at that point, that means that there is a quorum with 9 members present. One other item I want to take before we go further is I want to take this opportunity on behalf of the Finance Commission and the agencies to thank Stacy London for her service as the chairman. Stacy's shoes are smaller than mine, but they're big shoes to fill, and I will do my best. So if you would, please, let's show Stacy some appreciation. Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you, Paul.
We will deal with the minutes of the commission in the consent portion of the agenda. If there's anyone wishing to address the commission during the time of public comment, please fill out a witness affidavit form and bring it to the front. Public comments on non-agenda items are limited to 5 minutes and agenda items 10 minutes. Are there any, Charles, have we received any requests?
Not at this time.
Okay. One other item, members, please be gentle with me as I run the first meeting, because when I mess up, let's just go ahead and pretend like I didn't, and we'll go forward. So we are now on item 3, the consent agenda. Members, before we take up the consent agenda items A1 and C2 through 5 in a single vote, I want to state that any commission member may request that an agenda item be removed from the consent agenda and be placed on the regular agenda so that it may be discussed and voted on individually. Hearing no objection from members, do I have a motion to adopt the consent agenda items 1A, A1 and C2 through 5 without discussion?
So moved.
Second.
I have a move by Vince, second by Stacy. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion carries. Item number 4 is Finance Commission Operations. Commissioner Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought that it might be of interest, since the session is coming up, to give the members some general information. So the session begins on January the 8th. Last year, our last session was January the 10th, so the bills filed on the first pre-filing date this time 466, last time 513, so about the same amount. Bills filed through yesterday 754, so a lot of activity. Last session, total bills filed was 7,051. Bills passed 19%. So a lot of bills get filed that don't get passed. We do have, as of as of yesterday, 228 bills that were filed last session have been filed already. A couple other statistics in the Senate. We have 5 new members. In the House, 27 new members out of 150. So on the bills, each agency in their section has the bills that they're tracking, so you'll have that information. And again, the session begins on January the 8th, so there'll be a lot of activity going on before our meeting in February. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Let's move on to item number 5, discussion and possible vote to take action on the agency's fiscal year 2019 internal auditor's risk assessment and audit plan as prepared and presented by McConnell and Jones LLP. And I'd ask Molly to lead that discussion, if we could, please.
Great. Thanks, Paul. If we could have you guys come up and present, or however you're going to be doing the presentation, would be great.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to thank all of you for cooperating with us over the last month or so in terms of us getting through this risk assessment. And what we'd like to do today, I'm here with Darlene Brown, who is our Director of Internal Audit, who is the leader of this account along with me, and J.J. Reyes. They both conducted the risk assessment, talked to the commissioners, and came up with a very detailed document, a detailed document as well as a comprehensive internal audit plan that we want to present to you going forward for FY 2019. Now, the way we're going to handle this presentation today is we're going to go through our risk assessment methodology to make sure that everyone is comfortable and understands how we did the risk assessment and came up with the priorities that we use to develop the annual internal audit plan. That's the first thing we're going to do. The next thing we're going to look at is what the risk factors were that we looked at. The risk factors, we're going to go over those in general, and they cut across all 3 of the agencies. Then we're going to walk you through our scoring system, which is color-coded and may be a little bit different than what has been done in the past. And what we want to do while we're doing this is feel free, if you have any questions during the presentation, to stop us, and we want to have an interactive dialogue to make sure that everyone has an element of understanding. Then we're going to go through the risk assessment by agency, discuss the risk assessment by agency and how we use the heat maps that are particularly used by in the COSO model, the COSO Enterprise Risk Assessment Model. So we're going to go through that because the heat maps are what we used to determine what the priorities were in terms of what we'd look at in the internal audit plan. And then finally, we're going to present to you the plan. Now, our plan is not to go through each individual agency. What we want to do is we want to go through one risk assessment. That'll be DOB first. And all of the rest of them follow the same format, and they're pretty much self-explanatory unless you have specific questions because you got this in advance. And then before I sit down, I want to say this parenthetically. We have already begun the process for the bolt-on efficiency review coming out of the Sunset Report. So everyone's been very cooperative with that. We've already had our initial focus groups and our initial workshop, and now we're going to go into the individual specific interviews beginning next week. So that gives you an idea of where we are. We're off and running, and we have had a great experience so far, and we expect to continue to have a great experience. So I'm going to bring up, yes, sir.
Where's the placement?
Oh, not today. Oh, you know what? We just can't get all this information on 111x17 front and back. If we could, because quite frankly, we love the placemat. We prefer it. Okay. Thanks, Ms. Puente. Okay, I'm going to bring up Darlene now and JJ, and they'll handle it from this point forward.
Thank you, OD. apologize for not having a placemat. As ODC said, there's a lot of information in this packet. And so we're going to step you through the process, and it begins in your packet, page 27, if you could turn to that page. So our risk assessment methodology is that we took your strategic plan, the prior audit reports that we read through, we looked at the budget, the financial report, and also the sunset reports. And the sunset reports played a big factor in it. We looked at used the self-evaluation report to determine what was going on in your operations, what were the roles and responsibilities. So that really facilitated our risk assessment and it allowed us to get it done very quickly. Then we had interviews with key process owners, so every department in each one of the agencies we spoke with. We also deployed an electronic survey to every employee in each agency, and we had really good response rates, anywhere from almost 90% down to slightly over 63-64%. So those were very positive responses that we had. And then we also looked at key management reports. We looked at the reports that are included in your packets to see what is the information you're being provided and make sure that everything that you're being provided, there's processes in place to make sure that there's accuracy and timeliness on those. So we combined all of those together, and we came up with the scoring that we'll talk about. But our risk factors on the next page, we looked at the control environment for each agency, and the control environment is basically it's the integrity and ethical values. It's the structure of the organization to make sure there's appropriate segregation of duties. We looked, does each agency evaluate risks when they're making their decisions for new programs or new business processes? And then we looked at the philosophy of each management style. We look at how agencies manage change, and then we look at the completeness, commitment to competence, and you have very seasoned, very professional staff there. Each agency, they're all dedicated to the mission of their agencies. We looked at processes in place to ensure that there's compliance with laws and regulations, and we looked at the oversight to make sure staff are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And then under policy management, making sure that the planning and budgeting policies and procedures are in place, and then you have human resources in place, management in place. Performance management, that's how efficient and effective your operations are, and as you know, we're looking at that from the efficiency study also. And then what performance measures you have in place, and you have a lot of performance metrics that are being reported on in each time you meet. Information management, that's how the information flows both verbally and written and electronically. And then how people communicate within the organization, both internally and externally to your stakeholders. Resource management, that's where you look at human resources, you look at the cash, you look at the estimations that are coming in and the assessments. We evaluated those all on a 1-3 score. 1, low risk, 2, medium risk, and 3 is a high risk to the agency. Then we also, throughout the interview process, we looked at the business characteristics of that particular function. And if there were a high number of variables, either out in the market or internally, then that would have got a 2-3 score, for example. We looked at your financial statements and we rated risk-rated line items within the financial statement and processes that feed into those financial statements. And if there was complexity or the particular thing was a higher percentage of your balance sheet, that received a 2-3 versus the 1. Then the fraud risk, we looked at the amount of manual processes that might be involved that create an opportunity, higher risk for potential fraud. And not only fraud, but of the reputation of each agency. And then the characteristics of an account is the number of calculations and complexities in the process. So we had a big, long, wide spreadsheet matrix, and everyone had a 1-3 score. So under control environment, for example, if there were if it had a significant impact on compliance or regulations, it received a 2.45-3, and I'm now on slide 29. If it was a moderate impact on internal controls or, again, regulations, it was 1.45-2.4. So here's your red, yellow, green, and if little or no impact, 0-1.44. The same thing for performance management, it's same rating scale. If it was low, it was 0-1.144. If it was a moderate risk, it was 1.45-2.44. And if it was a high risk, it was 2.45-3.0. All the way across the board for each one of those 8 factors that we looked at. So do you have any questions so far on the scoring?
Yeah, a little basic question.
Sure.
You know, the basic thing would be you got 3 points, it's 0-1, 1-2, 2-3. Why are you doing 1 point, you know, almost 1.5 in the first category, 1 in the second category, and only about 0.5 in the last category?
We use a formula in our spreadsheet and divided all of the factors across, and then 1, 2, 3, and this is how it came out.
So you're seeing that come out different on somebody else?
It could possibly, depending if they use the same factors that we were using in each one of these areas. The scoring could possibly come out differently, but it should come out exactly the same.
And I'm guessing, Darlene, if we wanted to go into the actual items, you've got the scoring template that we could do, could take a look at.
Mm-hmm. And so some of this, and the reason why it may not come out exactly the same is because some of this, there is a little bit of subjectivity to it. It's not a hard numbers. It's our professional judgment on the impact on the specific activities. So in total, there was a possibility of 32 points across the board. We're now on page slide 31 for you. And we combined the averages of each one of those 9 and applied the same scoring criteria of 1 to 3. And when we come up to the next slide, which is 32, I believe, for you. This is our heat map. And so what you're seeing on this heat map, for example, on the Department of Banking, is the 9 factors on the left-hand side, how they roll into the heat map. And you'll see that information technology was one of the higher risk rating versus administrative services, which is the lowest one. And pretty much that bandwidth between high and low is pretty narrow. And what that represents is that each one of these agencies, and you see it in all three of your agencies, each one of your agencies are very mature with very stabilized and established processes, and senior professionals that have been in the organization and their roles for a while. So you don't have a lot of fluctuations and a lot of changes. Everybody's each process is well documented. Everybody knows what they're supposed to be doing and how they're supposed to do it. Now, if you were to change or add a program into one of your agencies or change one of the leadership out, you would probably see an up or a down in some movement in each one of those ratings. But right now, everything's really stable, and that's why you see everything falling into a narrow bandwidth. And that's the same for each one of your agencies.
So I'm kind of surprised. Give me some examples, if you would. Like, I'm surprised legal is as high as it is. What would be some of the factors that would make it that high?
So we had the same question from each one of your commissioners when we presented it. Legal is because they're helping your leadership team interpret what the regulations are and enforce those regulations. Also, they're preparing the cases for administrative action and tracking any fines that might be assessed, fines and penalties that would be assessed. And so And you'll see with banking that we have fines and penalties as one of the audits we'd like to do this year, because it's all maintained within the legal area right now. Hmm. So that rated high versus administrative services and accounting, finance rated lower, where you would expect that to be higher. And the reason is because within accounting there's mandatory structure in place from the comptroller's office that each one of the agencies has to follow. They have to use the same system to report their financial transactions, and they're always getting audited. And so, mm-hmm. and you know yourselves that you're probably receiving an audit or at least one or two a year from somebody in your finance area. Mm-hmm. So that's why they rated lower than what you would have intuitively expect.
Okay.
Any questions on the Department of Banking heat map? So then when we go to the next page, which is the SML's heat map. It's basically the same. Information technology was number one risk and legal number two. And then towards the middle is where there's some differences between agencies. But again, you still have finance rated one of the lowest ones. And it follows the same principle. It's because they're always getting audited and they have that same structure in place.
So on this one, I was kind of surprised that licensing wasn't higher because I, you know, all the fees and everything are coming in, you know, from the licensing, and you've got so many, you know, different mortgage individuals that are, you know, applying.
And the reason licensing did not come in higher is because they have standard audit programs that they use. They're applied consistently, and the money is coming in, but it's coming in through finance, and there's controls around that whole process. And so that's the different way that we look at things. Uh-huh. We look at what is – we break things down rather than looking at the whole function itself. What are those processes that support that particular business function, and where do those roles really lay? And as I walk through a couple more slides and go through the banking risk assessment, you'll see how we map that out on a grid. And okay. Then that's how we came up with these risks also.
Darlene, could I also ask? So sure. In particular, on SML, fees and penalties are a separate item, whereas on DOB and OCCC, they were just not broken out from legal. Mm-hmm. Why the differential there?
Because we felt like the fees and penalties had were a more more exposure within the SML organization versus the others. There was more activities, and it's also more separated within SML than the others.
Okay.
Are there any more questions on SML? Okay. And we can always go back and answer questions. So on the OCCC, we had, again, information technology is the highest risk. But here, legal came down towards the lower end because they have we felt like they had a less of an impact on the reputation and the internal controls and operations than in the other two agencies. Although they still play a very important function, their roles within that particular agency are a little bit different than in the others. And so, again, finance was the lowest rating. And here we do have examinations as a higher rating than in the other two agencies. Okay.
Let me ask you a question. I'm trying to get my head around this. And the thing that continues to strike me when I look at these heat maps is how tight the bandwidth is around the various subsections that you're describing here. And so it's sort of hard to get my head around what the differential is without really going deep into the data to understand what drives those things, because it strikes me that, you know, a modest subjective change in the evaluation process might change the order of these. And so it's sort of hard to get my head around whether this you have to rank them some way, I suppose, but these all sort of seem to be fungible. Probably is not the right concept, but it sort of has that feel to me about it.
So what we're seeing here is the result that, as I stated, everybody has pretty stabilized operations within each one of these functions. So what's primarily causing the differences is either the impact on the financial statements or the impact on operations, and which is why information technology is very high on all of these, and then the amount of turnover that might be in each one of the employee turnover that might be in each one of these functions. So every time you have employees turnover, that reaches raises your risks up a little bit because you have training that they have to go through. They have to learn the processes. They may not grasp each one of those processes immediately, and there might be a little error in what they're doing and not get caught. Those are the primary drivers. So that's why it was important to us in our methodology that we stuck to those 9 key evaluation instruments based on the COSO model, and that we kept to the consistent 1-3 scoring methodology. And then the survey's results also played a large impact into this. So the survey results, the scores varied by agency. And we also had a 1 to 3 factor in each one of those questions. So each question we asked on the survey mapped to one of these 9 areas. And then if somebody was having a bad day, and we saw from the survey consistently that it was negative answers, and they were just we didn't include that into the assessment. We threw that one out of the scoring. That so we tried to get it normalize the population here and make some sense.
And how many surveys did you do for each department?
Every employee received a survey. JJ, can you pull up? Do you remember? Can you pull up that information by any chance? Okay. I'll look that up real quick. Can you take over right here?
Well, within the surveys, each department within each agency received a survey, and then based on the survey itself, depending on what position you held. So if you were within the IT department, you may receive specific questions that were toward the governance and the framework of management within the government. If you were within legal, there were going to be specific questions that dealt with in the legal department, and then within finance, certain areas within finance. So if you had key specific areas, well, those questions would go to you, and you would be able to answer those through the survey. And then all that information was brought together and kind of, you know, mapped together in that sense. Well, one clarifying thing on the COSO framework. So the COSO framework is a management framework. And one of the things, the key thing about the COSO framework is the management from a top-down approach. So from the very top of your senior leadership to the very bottom of your team, the lower guys on the totem pole, does everybody have a strict understanding of what the policies and procedures are? What is your objective? What is the mission of the mission statement of your organization? And what are the key areas within your department or division? Those processes are being completed. Is there a business framework that supports that? Are there policies and procedures? Is there directives? And then so what we do is when we do these surveys and interviews, we take that approach, asking from the top all the way down, asking specifically almost the same kind of questions, and determine what type of information is received from that particular person. If at the bottom, they may not have an understanding that if, on a policy, or they're not aware of a policy, don't know where to find that policy, they may score lower. But in the middle management side, they may know where everything is at, and the senior leadership definitely knows because they're the ones who are pushing it down. So from that perspective, that's how we measure that as well within that division.
I'm not able to pull up the survey, but we will get that information to you. On the next slide is we consolidated the internal audit plan for you so that you wouldn't have to keep flipping back and forth to the different slides. But our proposal for this fiscal year is to do an information technology audit across the board, all three agencies. And I'm going to have JJ talk to you a little bit about that, why and what we intend to do. And then within banking, we propose to look at the fines and penalties tracking, and that is primarily because when a fine or a penalty is issued, that information stays in the legal department and is not recognized in your financial information until the revenue is received. So we want to look at the controls around that to make sure that if you assessed a fine or a penalty 4 or 5 years ago and there's a changeover in staff, that somebody's still monitoring to make sure that final penalty is attempted to be collected. Under for OCCC, we're also going to look at the investment administration of the TIFI fund, and that's just a regulatory requirement. That's a compliance. That's trying to think compliance requirement every 2 years. So that really didn't have a lot. It's not based on risk, it's compliance. And then we'll also follow up on prior audit findings across each one of the agencies. And we're going to do that throughout the year to make it more efficient. If we're looking at an area already, we're going to look and see if there's already prior findings, and we'll see what the implementation status is on that. And then also something that I think is a little bit different than what you're used to is we're going to update the risk assessment and propose for the audit plan for 2020 at the end of this fiscal year rather than at the beginning of the first next fiscal year, so that you can have an audit plan for 2020 approved before you actually go into the next fiscal year. So we'll try and we'll have that done before your August, whenever you're meeting around the July-August time frame. Then we'll issue out the annual report for each agency. Again, that's usually August, September time frame, and then there's audit communications throughout the period. So in total, we plan to spend roughly 488 hours and for a total of $58,651. Now, that number is smaller than what you approved in the contract, and that's because you've already spent money on this risk assessment. So this is the remainder of the funds that were approved in the contract, less the funds that were approved for the efficiency audit, and this is the balance. So in total, between the efficiency audit, this risk assessment, and the audits that we intend to do, we will not exceed the contract value of $100,000.
So this is the fun part that I'm sure that a number of people have questions, and that's
sure.
On your, like, page 37, 38, you know, where you have the prior audits.
Mm-hmm.
And so a question I've got is, it looks like the regulated lenders examination for OCCC hasn't been done since 2010. Do we feel, and another question I have is there anything that would keep us from having additional audits done throughout the year? Is there some reason why we wouldn't, instead of just having one audit, have, you know, two audits?
Okay, traditionally has happened with your internal audit is it seems like you're on a cyclical audit cycle rather than looking on what's truly impacting your business or your agency from a risk perspective. So a lot of things that we look at actually would be included in some of these areas already. It's just not we don't take that cyclical approach with because examinations are, even though they're a high priority, a main focus of your agency, if you have processes in place that are consistent and you have checklists and you have audit programs that are being monitored and updated according whenever there's changes in the regulations, it's not necessarily going to have a huge impact on your reputation or on your compliance. There's other things that could play into that would, and so we're looking at all of those little processes and functions that go into the examination process rather than taking that as a whole.
So you would think that the regulated lenders exam, that there's no real need to be doing it, that it's low risk when it comes to?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay, and then what about the mortgage licensing and registration?
It's the same process. They're using a system
right.
that is pretty well tightened down and with little control over. And so.
Little manual control. Okay, so it's all automated.
Correct.
Okay.
Let me ask maybe a related question, but going back to page 35, so on all three agencies, you've got IT, a change of management is kind of the top. Well, each agency is going to have that, where a lot of the hours are being spent. So. For this year, assuming that those audits go reasonably well, then when you do this for the next year, how will information technology be reflected on your heat map? I know that's kind of a real general question, but it'll change, though, right?
Mm-hmm. It may change depending on what we find
right.
in the change management process.
Okay, so if it does change, and even though it is probably one of the most important things that everybody deals with, do you circle back on there in the third year or something like that? Or does it every year it depends on your heat map?
Every year depends on the heat map, and the heat map is dependent upon the risk assessment results because there could be changes in your operations, especially with this efficiency audit coming up. The heat map might look completely different next year. So that's why we feel it's important to go back, and it's kind of like a zero-based budget. You start from fresh again every year, and we're also Since we're now in your operations, we're monitoring all your risks on an ongoing basis, too. And so we always have our ears and ears to the ground and eyes looking at things.
And let me also say parenthetically that the follow-ups are built into every audit plan. So anything that we find there, we'd be following up on where you were with the implementation of those recommendations and corrective actions. And that would also fold into the subsequent year's risk assessment. So that's the way all that ties in, if you were looking at technology.
And so I'd like to have JJ talk about the information technology audit right now, since we are on that topic.
So the way we determine the change management, it's within the IT field. So if you look at your listing of audits that were completed, you're talking about management information systems, and then there's also one that was done for testing of your network security. And so those specific areas that we're looking at, to give you the best way of looking at it, those are perimeter testing. We're testing the fence line. And so we're looking at those. That's what those type of audits are doing. They look at and they test the fence line all the way around the agencies to make sure that we're protected from the outside in. And so what change management does is we're actually looking on the inside of the perimeter now. We're looking at what we do within our own organization. So through our interviews and through our risk our surveys, we determined that there was key applications or software programs that are being developed within the organization. And there's also key software programs that are managed or are we're in a contract on a third-party basis, basically, but they're key within our organization. And so what we're going to do with the change management is we're going to look at the framework and the management of that specific of those specific areas. How does a change within the organization, whether it's a coding change or a change to an upgrade, how is that managed? From the top down, and if there is a issue that occurs, how do we fix that issue? And what it does is it goes back and it looks specifically at every process that's touched by IT, and kind of looks at it to make sure that we have the proper framework to address it. Because if there's a break within those areas, it affects you operationally, and it affects you financially. Also, it gives you an opportunity to look at it from a strategic perspective. If there's within the area that we look at and we see specific areas that are deficient, or that need a stronger management from a strategic perspective, you can look at that and say, okay, these are the resources that we need to develop or that we need to, you know, present to that particular opportunity to address it. And so that's the difference of what we're going to be doing within, and it's from an IT perspective and less from a financial perspective. Any specific questions on that?
Okay, one more. So at least two agencies deal quite a bit with the NMLS system, and I'm trying to think of what, based on what you just said, since that is a third-party system, can you give me an idea of what you think y'all will be looking into on that side of it from the change management standpoint?
Sure.
Maybe there's not any. I'm not sure.
Right. So first thing that we look at is updates. How often do they do the updates? Is there a strategic management way of doing those updates? Does the organization, when those updates, know when it's going to happen? How are they communicated to them? Is it an email sent to them? Is in that email there's a link, and we're supposed to push that link? And, well, how do we know that link is really a good link? I mean, could there be opportunities within that particular area? So we're going to look at that first off, is how those upgrades are done. Secondly, what is the relationship between the agency and that third party? So looking at it from a contractual basis, if there's a contract that's in there, who owns the data, who's in charge of it, who supports it? If they crashed on their end, what do we do on our end? Do we have a contingency plan? Do we have anything specific to address that particular area? Simple, basic blocking and tackling of how important is that particular application or software program to the organization. It sounds from, just in the interviews ourselves, it's key, right? So if it's key and it goes down, what can we do? Can we do things manually? Can we pull out the old spreadsheet and get it done? how long does it have to be, or, you know, do we have an idea of we can survive 3 days, we can survive 5 days, we can survive 10 days, we can survive 8 days, you know, that type of thing. Next thing is the data. All the data that's being captured on that. Who owns that data and who's responsible for that data? From a third-party perspective, do we own the data or do they own the data? Are they managing the data and are they securing the data the way they should? Because if there's a breach on that particular end, we don't want our names in the Austin American Statesman, but it was us that did it. You know, it's them that did it. And so we own some of that responsibility, so we want to, you know, define that and make sure that we have that documented. So that's some of the things that we would look at. And that's very high level. And then as we go through the assessment with the particular process owners, we'll get more in depth and we'll get to the more of the key control areas and test those key control areas to give you the assurance that, yes, we do have something in place to address those objectives, or we need something to be developed a little bit better. So.
So I'll just add on to that. So NMLS is a very key system, and you really don't have any control of when changes are made to that system. None at all, really. I mean, you can have input, but the federal government's going to make a change if they want to make the change. But what we need to look at is once that change is made, how does that information get from the NMLS system to the various systems that your agencies do use and needs to be updated? For example, the fees and the financial information that might come from that, how is it going to get to your financial statements? Those are the things that we're looking at, too.
So if I could ask in particular on NMLS, sure. Do you have any interaction in your process with NMLS and the people at NMLS? Does it go to that level?
We will reach out to whoever your agency's contact is at NMLS to see what that working relationship is.
So their cooperation is part of the process?
It will be.
And that's one of the risk factors we'd look at, too, within the contract or within the relationship that you have. Do you have that type of relationship with them? You may or may not. So we'll show it to you. We'll say, yes, you do have that relationship. You do have these key contacts to address these specific areas, or you do not, and these are the weaknesses. So we need, from our perspective as a team, we need to determine what we need to do in case something does happen.
Okay. So the next couple of pages are the audit by history, and we got that from your annual internal audit reports. This is a schedule that you're used to seeing, and so we will keep this schedule up as we go through our various years in the contract. Same legend and everything. So if you would go to page 41, I'm going to walk you through what the framework for each agency's risk assessment report looks like. And this report is not the report that will be going to your oversight bodies and out to the state and the governor. This report is for you. We have a consolidated report that that you'll be approving here later on. So for each agency, we started out with what the agency's mission and the operational objectives and what they oversee. And it was really important to have this in here because then you can see, okay, what we looked at, how does that tie back to the mission or the objectives of each agency? And then as we go through pages 42 on up to 45, we took each agency's organization chart and we laid out by each department what the key responsibilities are for each one of those departments. And then so that again then maps back to our heat map and our risk assessment scoring. So for example, under banking and trust supervision, they were responsible for each one of these activities, strategic support and so forth. And then on page 46, we have the primary business functions for the agency as a whole. And, for example, the banking has 17 primary business functions. Now, there's a lot of processes and sub-functions and activities that go into these 17 primary functions. And through this process, once we've completed the risk assessment, we actually had a meeting with each agency's leadership team and walked through this risk assessment report and made sure that everybody was in agreement with what was in here. And each agency did have some corrections for us, and we included these in here. So now everybody's in full agreement that, yes, this is, these are our primary functions, these are our primary roles and responsibilities of each one of these.
You know, I think it would be interesting looking at your efficiency type study to overlap these and see where there's, you know, consistencies and where certain things are done in a different area within the various agencies. So, I mean, this is good from that perspective, though, too.
That's exactly.
You guys using it that way?
Yes, we are. We are.
Just to follow up on that, Molly, the Sunset Review Commission had asked us to look at those synergies that we could look at, and so you'll be able to identify those through these audits,
right?
Correct?
Yes. Yes. So we were in the fortunate position that as we were going through the risk assessment, we were already knowing that we were going to be doing the efficiency audit. So we tried to leverage our interviews as much as possible, the data that we gathered. And then as we go to the next slide, not only the slides you've just looked at, where it lays out the responsibilities by each function, we mapped each function to the sub-processes. So that starts on page 47 for you. So there's primary functions, and we said, okay, for example, under access control management, well, really information technology and administrative services are responsible for access controls. When you go down to budgeting, everybody has a piece of the budgeting. So this is how the matrix is laid out. And then for the efficiency audit, we combined all three of these agency matrices, and we can clearly see where there's potential duplicates. Mm-hmm. And this are what our team's responsibility is to see if there really is duplicates in there.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
And so that's how we've laid out. And then when you go to page 49, this is more detail of for each specific agency's audit plan. So this is a what I have already summarized and talked about previously. And then when you go to page 60, 50, this lays out more detail of what our information technology change management audit is, and that JJ's spoken to you about it. What we will do, and we'll look at the change management policies in place. We'll conduct interviews. We'll look at samples, some software patches, upgrades and changes to make sure that if you do have a change management policy in place, that policy is actually being followed. Under the fines and penalties, we're going to look at the policies and procedures around. Now, it's important to stress that we're not looking. This audit is not to see if you're how much you're assessing and how you determine about what the assessment is. It's looking to make sure that once that fine or penalty has been assessed, what's the structure in place for recording it, collecting it, monitoring the status collection, and how you record the revenue once it's received and reported out. So it's still the agency's decision on how they're going to assess those fines and penalties. That's not what this audit is about. It's about once that is assessed and in writing and agreed upon, and how does it go from that point forward.
Can I ask a question back on, I'm sorry,
sure.
On page 50 on the IT change management? So let's, and I'm using this purely for an example's
sure.
purpose. Let's say you looked at MLS and you found that NMLS was highly deficient. For some structural reason, either they, you know, there's a potential breach possibility, or their, you know, patch is late to the game when it's needed and it's not done. How does any negative finding you find on a third-party vendor factor back into us in the audit process?
That's a very good question. So we would provide NMLS your contact with that information, but from your point of view, it's something we would have to develop a recommendation around what you can control, what you need to be monitoring to make sure that, for example, the breach situation, what processes do you have in place to make sure that NMLS is applying their patches, and what can you do if they don't apply those patches? What's in place to make sure that you can respond to a potential breach from your aspect of the data that you have?
Okay.
Because we know that you can't, you're not in a position to say you have to apply that patch. And
well,
you have
we're,
to do
we're
this.
Not in a position of control at all,
right,
and that's
exactly.
why I use that as an example.
That's a very good example to use, because we will focus on what you can control. and what you can do to help control.
So the what we can't control doesn't factor back into us in a negative way. Okay.
No. We'll still write it, but we'll identify it and we'll say, but you have no control over it.
Right.
And because you don't have the control, these are the things that you need to consider. Okay, so the next two agencies, and I hope OCCC and SML don't feel slighted, but since they follow the same structure, I won't go into all the detail of those reports for you.
Oh, please do.
Okay. And so we're asking for your permission and approval to adopt the FY19 audit plan.
Let me ask one question before then. So say we don't have any structure, we don't have any limitation on fees or anything like that. Is there anything that you feel the risk would warrant you looking at it without, you know, is there anything out there that you would recommend that we do the audit of that is a risk to a level that we should be aware of?
Nothing came to our attention during the risk assessment process. Now, as we go through the efficiency audit, there might be some additional that comes up, but from our risk assessment process, no.
Okay. All right, so with that, I will move to accept their audit plan the way it's presented.
Members, are there any other questions of our internal auditors? Hearing none, I have a motion to approve the agency's fiscal year 2019 internal auditor's risk assessment and audit plan as prepared and presented by McConnell and Jones, LLP. That motion was made by Molly. Is there a second?
A second.
I have a second by Laurie. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. The ayes have it, and the motion passes.
Thank you. And I just want to say, this was a lot tied to digest, so pick up the phone or send us an email if you have any further questions. We're more than happy to answer them.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, members, we'll go to item 6, which is discussion of and possible vote of to take action on revisions to the Finance Commission's policies and procedures regarding training, budgeting, and travel reporting. Commissioner Cooper.
So beginning on page 77, you have a red line of the recommended changes, modifications to this area. Then you also have a clean copy in there. Some of these changes just kind of came about as a matter of fact, and some of them were recommended through the sunset process. And I think some of them we probably talked about over the years. So here we are, not a lot of modifications, but I would say would be very, very meaningful. As an example, on page 36, on the travel reporting, if you remember, on the sunset process, they wanted us to be a little bit more detailed on some of the travel reporting so you, as the governing body, could determine if some of the commissioners are spending too much time in Washington, D.C., as an example. A breakout of that. So anyway, it just provides you the information in order to do your job.
So, Charles, with that particular comment that you just made, when you talk about the regulatory supervision, it seemed to me that that should be broken out further. So, in other words, you have travel that's related to doing examinations and things like that, and then you have travel that would be related to meetings that could fit into what you were talking about, like going to Washington for a meeting, you know, with the FDIC or something like that. So my question is, should we break it out, that section, further? One for examinations and then one for, you know, like if you're on a panel somewhere or, you know, you're meeting CSBS or something like that. should that be another category?
Well, we believe that that's, and y'all help me, we believe that that's captured in other regulatory activities. The numbers, I think the numbers when we kind of went through them are not that large, but...
Well, and some of it, on the regulatory supervision, we were looking at, and we had a lot of robust discussion amongst the three agencies about, you know, what is our key mission and what are our key responsibilities, and in terms of regulatory supervision, mm-hmm. what are the activities that we expend funds for travel for that are really integral to the regulatory supervision. So that was the discussion amongst the three agencies, and that's our recommendation to you. But, of course, you know, if you – I mean, there is another category for other regulatory activities, but if you that was the conclusion we came to. But, of course, y'all can further deliberate on that issue.
Okay. Well, I guess I would just take that last sentence. Maybe if you take that last sentence and push it under other regulatory activities –
Well, respectfully, again, devil's in the details. It really depends on what we're talking about. For instance, you're talking about the last sentence under regulatory supervision?
Yeah. Like, give me an example of what that would be.
Well, it says also included is travel related to meetings with other regulators, financial education, outreach, and speaking. So it could be our Caroline and I and some of our staff go to meet with the FDIC in Dallas. Mm-hmm. I think that follows under there. Now, that's not going to Washington, D.C. for to meet with the chairman of the FDIC, I don't think. Excuse me, not chairman of the FDIC, for meetings that we have up there, such as CSBS board meetings and things like that. That would be under other regulatory activities. That would capture what I would call not unusual, but it separates normal regulatory activities from things like that. Like I would be possibly could be going up and talking to Congress about when I did my testimony. That would go under other regulatory activities. They're not.
What about if you were asked to be on a panel in Hawaii?
It would go under other regulatory activities.
It would go under other?
Yeah, I believe that's right. Somebody, Stephanie, would you come up here, Steph?
I would hope that they would pay for your travel, just to say, but I'm using that as an example.
Yeah.
They should.
Well, let me add, though, of those type of things, if you look at the memos.
Stephanie Niebuhr,
Texas yourself. Department of Banking, sorry. This is to break down the travel categories. The actual complete detail is in the division memos as well. If you look at the division memo that Kurt prepared, it shows all the speaking engagements that the commissioner did and anybody else that's in the executive area of the agency.
But it doesn't show the cost. It shows that they went, but it doesn't show the cost.
Right, and we can add that if you'd like. But what we were trying to do with our four categories is regulatory supervision goes to the mission of each agency. You have to meet with the FDIC.
Right.
You know, those kind of things, you have
right,
to do
I get
those
that.
Things.
Yeah.
When we went down, what we thought other regulatory activities was more something that is not necessarily something we have to do to get our job done. But it is important to the agency to stay involved with CSBS, to get involved with legislative fly-ins.
Right.
And that's how we broke the two categories down. When we did this report for Sunset, this is pretty much the three categories that they used. The only thing we added was non-employee, because like for y'all's travel, we didn't have a place to put that. And I think we were pretty consistent with how they wanted us to do it. Their deal was it's like going up to another state, basically.
Right.
That's what they really wanted to see.
And that's why I just want to make sure, and it to me it wasn't clear, that when you did the speaking or panel engagements, that could be, to me, other.
Well, and that's why we had a long discussion on this as well.
Yep.
And we said when it's associated with a regulatory matter. So we are invited by Money Transmitters Regulators Association. They asked me to come speak to the members of the industry. For us, we felt that was regulatory supervision, that we are going somewhere, and it may be out of state, but we are doing it for the population that we regulate. And so if it is for your regulated population, it's regulatory supervision. If you're just asked to come speak somewhere like a chamber of commerce of another state, I mean, and that's a bad example, but something like that where it's not our regulated
population.
Like
IBAT or something, or, you know, some trade association.
Some trade association where it's not just your licensees, or it's –
Right.
It's not to your regulated population. That goes down in other regulatory activities.
Okay.
And generally, I think you kind of mentioned, generally on those type of deals,
you're reimbursed.
Reimbursed. I'm trying to come up with a good example. Stephanie spoke and. About a couple of weeks ago.
At a International Money Transmitters Conference, which a lot of our licensees attend, and I was reimbursed, but it would go under regulatory supervision because we spoke about our regulation to our population. If I went to somewhere and just spoke about money service businesses in general, like, you know, to some group that wanted to get involved in that, or another state or something.
Some new fintech group,
yes, that we don't license. We put that in other regulatory. And we, in our discussions, we sort of felt strongly that if we're doing it for the industries we regulate and we are helping them stay in compliance with the law, that is part of our regulatory supervision. That is part of our job. If we're invited to come speak to our industries, that really is part of our job.
Okay, so you use the example of IBAT would be another, but to me then
no,
IBAT would be
not
in regulatory.
No, IBAT is regulatory supervision because it is our licensees.
Yes. Okay.
So some of us spoke at TBA, attorney convention in San Antonio, so travel down there in the hotel, if any, would go under above, not below. If I would go to a CSBS meeting in D.C., for instance, we had a board meeting in Savannah, and related activities that would go below. And I think, when we looked at it, Molly, I think you'll be surprised the number's not very large. Not very large.
Well, and I guess
I'm sorry, Stephanie's right. We will make a comment that so and so went so and so in your board package, and if you want to ask where does that go, and we'll be prepared to tell you.
Or even when we're looking at the travel reporting, if we see a number, we can always ask more information on it if it jumps out.
Exactly. And what we plan to do for the first quarter reporting period, because we just did, in our budgets, we did travel in-state and travel out-of-state. And in our notes to the financial statements, we are going to have these four, the breakdown of these four for actual. We're not going to have the budget broken down because we just didn't have enough time to try to figure it out this way. But actual, we will show it in our notes to the financials.
It'll be in the
first quarter.
Where the variance statements and things are, we'll have a table in there.
Exactly.
Cool.
And so we hope that the changes that we're making to the policy today, I think it's management action 2.3 and 2.5 of the Sunset Report. We'll take care of that with this.
And I had one other question while I have you on.
Okay.
Talking about the budgeting thing.
Yes.
I think I remember in the back of my mind that, you know, we have certain things that we've always done, like it's tied to, you know, the OCC's, I think it's the Savings and Loan Department that has certain, like, they've always done their assessments based upon what the OCC has done or something like that. That's not in a policy anywhere, is it? And does this sentence that we're doing within the budgeting, does that take care of that issue that we have so that we can, you know, do the budgeting next year?
May I ask which sentence on what page you're looking
at? I'm just talking about budgeting in general.
It says
any changes, you know, flexibility in setting the fees and assessments is important. And I think it was you, Caroline, that was telling me that typically you've always done the fees for the industry based upon what the OCC, and it's always kind of been like 10% or whatever, and that we were talking about February, making sure we make that change. This is the policy, though. Can we have it be as
the policy.
Right. The rules that we have in the administrative code set how we're going to do our fees. Or it's either in the statute or it's in a rule.
Okay.
And so the rule says, for us, the rule says you will, your assessment can be X percent. What this gets says is that in your budgeting process, if you, the very last sentence of the budgeting section, this one right here,
uh-huh.
The very last sentence says that you have to do a comparison of your budgeted fees and assessments to the maximum fees or assessments allowed to be charged for each regulatory area. So what we're saying is if we're going to show you this is what we're actually putting in our budget, but this is what the law would allow us to do. So that's something we've not done. I think we've done it in footnotes, but it's something we're going to add to. So you can see that we are collecting only what we need for the expenditures that we have for that fiscal year. Does that help you?
Yeah. Are you comfortable with that? I don't need to, you know, in February we don't have to say, okay, it's not going to be 10% or whatever? Or
I'm comfortable that this is not in conflict with that. We're still discussing what recommendation to bring to you all in February.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's not in conflict, so we can.
I don't believe
okay,
so, no.
Great.
All right.
I have a question. I'm not sure who. Maybe it's because the first time I've really read this. But like on page 8.
8?
Yes, ma'am. Exhibit A. There's a bold line that says 572.051. Then it goes on to the next page. But then that same text repeats itself on page 14. And I understand that one of them is under standards of conduct. And another one's, I guess, is under ethics and policy. But is there really reason to repeat exactly what's been said before?
Well, only because it's an exhibit on page 8 and in the statute of our ethics policy in page 14, but that's something we could look at, just referencing it as opposed to reading it twice.
You want to make sure you get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's probably a weakness of mine anyway, so.
Yeah.
Members, are there any other questions?
Do you need a motion?
Go ahead.
Okay. Do I hear a motion? We're on item 6. Do I hear a motion to approve revisions to the Finance Commission's policies and procedures regarding training, budgeting, and travel reporting?
So moved.
Move by the Vice Chair. Do I have a second?
Second
by Stacy. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes. Members, items 7, 8, 9, and 10 will take up an executive session at the end of the meeting. So we'll go to the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, Commissioner Pettijohn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our report begins on page 155, and before I move into the written reports, I just have three items, newsworthy items, I guess, of industry-related and federal-related. First, a little bit of market news in motor vehicle financing. There's been observations of an uptick in average credit scores for vehicle financing across the board, which has caused the percentage of subprime contract originations to reach its lowest level in 11 years. This is according to Experian, and they have a state of the automotive finance market report, which has data from the third quarter, and they report that subprime and deep subprime lending make up 21.19% of the market, which is down about 1.5% from a year ago. Much of the decrease in the percentage of subprime financing seems to be driven by high growth rates in the lower risk segments, particularly in the used vehicle category. So more than 50% of the used market is now made up of prime and super prime borrowers for the first time since Q3 2010. So we're seeing some shift in that particular market. There's a senior director at Experian that said that shift in the market share can be attributed to many factors, including an improvement in consumer credit behavior and vehicle affordability. So that's just some little news item I caught recently about the motor vehicle market. I thought that might be of interest. And then second, in small dollar lending news, but also at the federal level, the FDIC is seeking comments on issues related to small dollar lending, including steps that can be taken to encourage FDIC-supervised institutions to offer small-dollar credit products that are responsive to customer needs and that are underwritten and structured prudently and responsibly. So this is a request for information that's out for comment. Comments are due January 22nd, but that's certainly an issue that a lot of the small lending market is interested in as well. That's been always an ongoing conversation and interest about can depository institutions serve any of that market need, and so that's of interest. And then also, you may have seen in news from Washington that the Kathy Craninger from OMB was confirmed last week as the new director of the CFPB. So I figured most of you had seen that, but in case, I just wanted to mention that. Okay, now moving into the reports. Page 155, we start with our consumer protection and consumer assistance report, and you see the examination activity. Again, we're just barely into fiscal year 19, so this is just 2 months of activity. So it's compared year over year with fiscal year 18. But we are on track with our prorated goals, a little ahead in some areas, a little behind, but overall ratios are fine, and again, it's very, very early. We have been active this first few months of this fiscal year with some new examiner classes. We've had two new classes of financial examiners that were hired, and they are in different phases of field training, but this will bring our field staff to a full strength. And so we've been working a lot in the training area, but getting these groups out and productive. But we're very pleased with the progress thus far with our two new financial examiner classes. On page 156, we move into acceptable level of compliance, again, early in the year, but we are very pleased to report that all groups are positive at 85% or higher. We hope that we will remain in that posture, but kudos to the industry for their good work so far this fiscal year in compliance ratings. If you look down on the bottom of page 156, on the trailing 12 months, we still see some volatility in the 12-month compliance rate for credit access businesses. Performance of 56% down there is the impact of some large enterprise exams that were conducted in the latter part of the year. We expect that to improve in long term. This should smooth out, but that's so we're optimistic about the levels of compliance moving into further into fiscal year 19. On page 157, you see information on investigations and complaints, and you'll see both categories are up significantly year over year. The biggest change, though, that we see, while the numbers are small in terms of, I said significantly, but percentage-wise maybe, but they're small numbers generally in total. But the trends that we're really beginning to see is a pretty strong movement that these activities are even more predominantly motor vehicle sales finance, as you see the differences between those year over year in by category. And both investigations and complaints. Our complaints are up 14% over the prior year in these last 2 months. Also, you'll note that we have begun reporting to you non-jurisdictional complaints. This is new information, so you'll have that. That was a recommendation that came out of Sunset that we sort of get together on some of these reporting measures and that they wanted to see non-jurisdictional information. So,
hey, Leslie.
Yes.
On the complaints, you know, we have investigations completed and complaints processed. Is there a way that we can, I think one of the other suggestions or recommendations from Sunset was that, you know, let's have an aging as to how, you know, how are we doing with getting from a time period. I think I saw it in the SNLs where it said, you know, on the aging.
So quarterly we report to you, we have a key performance measure, which we've had for years and years and years, about the percentage of complaints that are resolved within 90 days.
Okay.
And that's a key performance measure for us. But we will also be talking over time with the agencies. We're, you know, we're going through this efficiency audit, so we've got a lot of things happening. We're looking at the same time, but ultimately we'll be looking at trying to standardize some of those performance measures as we go.
And like applications processing, like the next thing, it's like how long does something take to get through the process?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Thank Commissioner,
you.
Can I ask?
We track all of that information. It's just sort of how do we report it to you? But we monitor it ourselves on a regular basis.
Development this week was with a federal piece of legislation talking about live checks.
Yes.
Does your department get many complaints regarding live checks?
We get occasional, but not, I wouldn't say it's a predominant source of complaints, but yes, we get some from time to time, but not, I wouldn't call it significant. On page 158, there's a little more detail about our motor vehicle sales complaints. They are running in as our largest complaint category. It's 67% of the complaints we've received. Last year at this time, that number was 52%. We've been seeing them in the 50% range. We're now seeing those in the 60% range and higher. So we're certainly watching that very closely, but it has really begun to be much more predominant in those activities. On page 159, I guess you'll continue to see, as we rank the ratio of complaints, you'll continue to see that playing out. This is the first time that I ever recall, but I know for sure in the last 3 years, because I went back and looked, that motor vehicle sales finance is in the number one position. Well, it's the highest ranked position in terms of the ratio of complaints to licensees. Usually they rank in, I mean, there's a large denominator and population of licensees. They usually come in about third or fourth position, and it's at the highest right now. So we're monitoring that. That's sort of a leading indicator for us. We're paying attention to those issues. on page 160, information on credit access business reporting, quarterly information. This is the information through the third quarter. There's just a couple of items here, but if you're looking at the 2018 calendar data, we may have already talked about this again, but we've seen the multiple installment product has pushed over the 50% limit in 2018 for both categories. And that we've seen the fee amounts as a percentage of the loan amount, and when you factor in the length of the term, those have declined somewhat over all product types over the last trend period reflected in the data. So that's just some couple of observations there. We'll continue to bring this forward as information is available. On licensing, the dashboards on page 162, I hole punched through the page number. And I would say, I would just characterize this, it's a little soon to tell because we're in the middle. The data presented to you here is in the middle of the quarter. It's at the end of October. So I'd like to, it's not exactly comparable quarter to quarter, year over year, because we've got another month of activity that needs to be reflected here. We're overall seeing a stable to a slight decline, I would say, trend for all regulated entities. Typically, our industries are somewhat countercyclical. When they see heightened activity during times of economic weakness, when economic indicators are strong, they sometimes see softening, and we see softening in the number of regulated industries. It's sort of anecdotal, but we've seen some of those trends. So it's a kind of a stable market right now. We're watching that closely. It'll be interesting when we put the first quarter data in there to see how that compares year over year. But for the most part, it's all fairly stable. I mean, the decline, if you look from Q1 17 to Q1 18, was just a negative 0.8%. So that's not terribly significant. That's very stable. But we'll see how Q1 19 data plays out when we get that at the February meeting. But we're, again, monitoring the indicators on that. On page 163, just a note that there's some key legislative dates in the first paragraph on the communications section. And obviously we talked about the legislature starts on January the 8th, but there's some other dates about inauguration and say the state address in that paragraph. And then I already previously mentioned we've been filling examiner classes as well as some other vacant positions. On page 166, I just wanted to mention in information technology, I think I'd shared with you a couple of meetings ago about our new phishing email training campaign, and so we ran our next phase of that testing through the staff of, you know, attempting to get them to to click on suspicious web links, and that we had much better success rate at 98.8%. So we're pleased with the positive training, the results from the training campaign. So that's positive. I'd be happy to answer any questions on those reports. If not, I'd like to call upon Michael Rigby to give the legal report.
Good morning. Michael Rigby, General Counsel for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. The legal report begins on page 167 of your materials, and I'll start off with the enforcement cases. We received one proposal for decision from the State Office of Administrative Hearings in a motor vehicle sales finance license application denial. There's a second step to that process where the proposal for decision comes back to the agency for entry of a final order. We also received or entered two final orders for two cases that resulted in a default. That is, the agency docketed those cases at SOA, and the respondents did not appear for the hearing. You can see at the bottom of page 167, we issued a significant number of enforcement orders with respect to pawn shops and pawn shop employees. These are late application violations, so under the statute, the pawn shop employees need to apply for a license within 75 days of starting their employment, and there's a significant number of those cases, so you'll see the numbers on page 168 increase probably next meeting. Let's see. I think that's it. We do have a rule action for the amendments to the pawn shop rules as a result of rule review, and Lori Hobbs will be presenting that.
And while Lori's coming up, I'll just mention our legislative report. It's page 172. There are seven bills total that we've presented to you here. These are very specific to areas that we regulate. There obviously are a lot of other bills we still track that might pertain to different matters that would reflect that pertain to our industries or to our agency in terms of operation. Six of these bills are very narrowly focused on payday loans and credit access businesses. And three of those were refiled from last session. And then one bill, Senate Bill 186, would affect both regulated lenders and credit access businesses. So the descriptions are provided to you there. These will start coming to you weekly. Once session starts, you'll get an email with this information. I think Commissioner Cooper talked about that earlier. But anyway, this is the report of what we have so far today. And with that, I think Lori's ready to begin discussion on item B2 that begins on page 175.
Yes. Thank you, Commissioner. Again, my name is Lori Hobbs, Assistant General Counsel with the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. This rule action we have for you today, item B2, is an adoption of amendments for rules regarding pawn shops and pawn shop employees. Just a brief overview regarding the process that we've gone through with these rules. The proposal implements changes resulting from the completed review of 7TAC Chapter 85, Subchapter A, that was adopted in October. This is from the standard review done every 4 years under the government code. In mid-August, we sent notice to stakeholders regarding the review generally of these rules. And then in September, we distributed a pre-comment draft and held a stakeholder meeting and webinar on the proposed changes. At the October meeting, the proposal was approved for publication and was published in November for public comment. A quick summary on the purposes of the rules as outlined in the proposal continued in this adoption. The three main purposes are to ensure consistency with current licensing terminology, agency procedures, and streamline processes, to remove obsolete language and modernize the rules, and also to make technical corrections. So there's several of the licensing rules that have generally been updated to conform to current practice, including the use of the OCCC's online portal. And part of the modernization also includes amendments to three rules updating agency enforcement procedures and terminology. So that leads to, we did receive one written comment on the proposal, and that related to the proposed changes in 85.604. Concerning enforcement action against pawn shop license or pawn shop employee. And the amendments to this rule better reflect the enforcement actions available to the agency under the finance code, and those actions are injunction, administrative penalty, suspension, and revocation. In general, the agency is moving away from an approach where every violation results in an immediate administrative penalty. Thus, we had added several references to injunctions. And the commenter had stated, quote, no statutory citation is provided for the changes updating enforcement procedures, end quote. In response to this statement, we have stated in the adoption the existing statutory provisions within Chapters 14 and 371 of the Finance Code authorizing the types of enforcement actions that may be taken against pawn shops and pawn shop employees. That discussion is included on page 181. However, the comment does not state whether it's for or against the adoption and does not provide any suggestions or recommended changes to the rule text. The commenter expresses concern about the public nature of enforcement orders and had requested additional information on the agency's policies and procedures for handling enforcement actions. Those requests are outside the scope of the rule amendments in 85604, and we have responded to the commenter's questions outside of the rulemaking process and have not received any further requests or additional inquiries from that commenter. So we feel that's resolved, and the proposed text of 85604, as well as the other rules included in the proposal, will be maintained for this adoption. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Ms. Hobbs?
But if not, we would request that the Finance Commission approve these rule amendments.
Members, do I hear a motion to approve the amendments in 7 TAC Chapter 85, Subchapter A, concerning rules of operation for pawn shops resulting from rule review? I have a motion by Cliff. Is there a second?
Second.
I have a second by Laurie. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion say aye. Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes our report.
Members, we'll take a it is now 5 minutes till 10 o'clock. We will take a 15-minute break and reconvene here at 10 minutes after 10 o'clock.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Under the general catch-all about current events and impacting the agency or our regulated entities, I'd like to mention three things. Number one is, as everybody knows, this is at the national level, the House of Representatives control flipped, and so we have a new chair of the House Financial Services Committee, Maxine Waters, congresswoman from California. She was the ranking member, and previously, Congressman Henserling was the chair. He didn't run, so I understand his portrait is now in the gallery. So we had a great relationship with Chairman Henserling and his staff, and fortunately, we've also maintained a working relationship with now Chairman Maxine Waters and her staff. So whether community banking bills will move forward next year or not, I guess it's kind of subject to debate. Chairman Crapo continues to be the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. And out of that, I mentioned previously that one of the relief bills that did pass and was signed into law, 2155, is the agencies are in process of implementing those provisions. And one of the provisions is the community bank leverage ratio. So community banks under $10 billion can theoretically have another standard to go by. And one of the things in the bill that we got Chairman Crapo to put in, and I've mentioned it previously, is that the federal agencies have to consult with the state regulatory authorities. And so they came out with their proposal on the leverage ratio. There is a call on it, I believe, next Friday. And in my opinion, they haven't, the federal agencies have not listened to what we've told them. So it's going to be, it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. It was intended to be regulatory relief, and it doesn't appear to be much of relief at this point in time. So you may hear some more about that, particularly in the trade journals. Would like to mention that y'all are aware of CSBS. We received our, we had an accreditation review, which is a deep dive into whether we're doing what we're supposed to do by CSBS, and by primarily the group that came in and looked at us were retired commissioners from other states, and they did a deep dive, and we received our approval for accreditation. It's our sixth accreditation we received, so we've been accredited by CSBS since 1993, and I have to be careful what I say, but we received one of the highest ratings ever given. So it's very, the staff really did a good job on it. So on page 205, the information is of August 31. It's not new, so we talked about it last meeting. Again, I'll point out that if you look down at the bottom, we have 11 banks that are rated 3, 4, or 5. That's kind of the barometer that you can go by on the well-being of the financial institutions. I kind of think that number, as I said before, will stay there. It'll bounce around that number. But we're also at 236 banks. So, again, this is not new information. The November information wasn't available. On page 206, I'll just mention down at the bottom, again, on 2155, it did have a provision in there that changed the required cycle for bank examinations. It used to be if you were over $1 billion, you would be examined annually. Now they raised that $1 billion to $3 billion, and so that does change our examination cycle. We have 16 banks that we regulate that are between the $1 and $3 billion range. So that will change our cycle on that. On page 207, on division highlights, the first bullet point that I will mention is that several years ago, CSBS and the Federal Reserve created the Community Banking Research and Policy Conference that's held annually in St. Louis, and the sixth conference was held in October. As we talked about a little bit earlier, here's the detail of the events that we attended in various fashions on the 207, the top of the 208. Beginning on 209 would be the applications that we've worked on. Ben Frazier is in the audience. And let me mention one thing that I forgot to mention. We did have a promotion since the last meeting, and Kurt Purdom is now the deputy commissioner. So, and Kurt's in the audience, and so congratulations again, Kurt. Okay, that'll be good. So now anything goes wrong, y'all can blame it on Kurt, okay? Because I will. But on page 210, we talk about this each time. I want to talk about the charter merger conversion activity. So the first bullet point is we had Vantage Bank completed its merger with International Bank in McAllen. And so that was one of our banks that acquired a national bank. So as far as the impact on the number of banks for us, it's zero, but our bank has grown in size. And then Union State Bank in Florence merged into Citizens National Bank of Henderson, so we lost one there. So, that is a something that we'll be discussing every meeting, and we deal with it. On page 211 would be the summary of the special audits. The numbers there are for fiscal year 2018. So, again, we discussed this last meeting. on the division activities on page 212. There's some interesting things there. If you'll read about our continued dealings with the Homeland Security on one particular situation, it's quite interesting, and it involves several other states. Page 213 talks about our strategic support area. It has the complaints, and this is the 2 months worth of complaints. You can see how it's broken down. So we had 65 complaints in that pie chart, and it breaks it down in the areas. This is what I'd say is normal activity, nothing unusual, unless there's something in there that y'all want to specifically talk about. On page 216, we have a top of the page, we have a kind of a new chart. It's the number of written complaints and that have been resolved. So that's new for y'all. I think that kind of a recommendation, I won't call it a criticism, but a recommendation that we've tried to work on. And again, on page 217, there's some more activities that have gone on within the department. And so closing the calendar year, you know, a lot of work has gone on, and obviously we'll be dealing with a lot once the session starts. So with that, I'd like to go into 218 would be the legal division update. Catherine, if you'd come forward, please.
Good morning, members. Just a couple of items that I wanted to bring to your attention from the legal division report, and I'm happy to answer any other questions. We don't have any rules for you today, so you're off the hook that way. But one thing that I mentioned last time at our last meeting was this very sad case against an unauthorized prepaid funeral contract seller. It's a funeral home here in Austin, Billy F. Peel and Son Funeral Home, or Austin Peel and Son Funeral Home. Billy F. Peel is the individual. We did reach a settlement with Mr. Peel. He has agreed to pay, I guess it's almost $525,000 in restitution to customers who purchased prepaid funeral contracts that were illegal because he held no license when he sold them. He is scheduled to make that restitution on or before February 15th, and so we felt like that was a very good resolution of a very unfortunate situation. He's also scheduled to pay a penalty of $250,000 to the department if he pays the restitution on time. If he does not pay the restitution on time, then the penalty raises to $520,000. So we've been in contact with his attorney since the order was issued, and he is making arrangements to, I believe, sell the funeral home to raise the funds to pay the restitution and the penalty.
Catherine, could I ask a question?
Yes.
So you answered the first question was, do you think he has the fiscal wherewithal to potentially pay the penalty?
Well, that's our hope.
Yes.
It's looking positive, but we'll see.
But secondarily, that restitution level, how does that compare with the actual loss? Is that 50% of it?
That's all of it.
Okay.
That's all of it. I will add one caveat to that, and that is, unfortunately, since the order was issued, a couple of purchasers have come forward to us with additional documentation that we did not have when we created our spreadsheet to come up with the final restitution number. So we're working on resolving that, getting that additional documentation from the folks that have come forward since then to verify that it is accurate, and then we're going to be back in contact again with Mr. Peel and his attorney to figure out how we're going to take care of those folks as well. But it's nominal. I mean, what we've heard so far is, I want to say, $3,000 to $4,000 in addition to the $525. So it's not a lot more. It's a little bit more, but we're going to do everything we can to take care of those folks too.
That's an excellent outcome. Thank you.
Thank you. The only other matter that I wanted to mention to you, and this is something that had come to pass before the last meeting, but it was it happened after the memo was prepared, and that is the resolution of our case against Connie Burgess. This is a banker out in Amarillo. We did get into a we reached a consent order with him following a mediation, which Commissioner Cooper attended, and Mr. Burgess agreed to pay a penalty of $75,000 and also pay for the department's investigative costs. Happy to answer any other questions.
Members, any other questions?
Thank you.
Catherine, so then on page 221 starts the bill reporting that each agency has. And then while on page 223, while on the consent calendar, I'd just like to say that Wallace Jones has served on our pre-need guarantee fund, and this is a reappointment of him, and he's just done an outstanding job, and really want to thank him for his service. And that's all we have, Mr. Chairman, unless we have questions.
Members, any questions? Let's move on to item D, the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. Commissioner Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I go into the charts that we talk about it at each meeting and update you on, I want to make some general remarks on what it is we're reporting to you and why. So the items that I'll mention in this section are useful in giving the Commission an overview of the thrift industry as a whole. There are items that the items we're providing you with are key regulatory areas of interest to the department at this time. There are other items we could mention, but these are the ones that we're particularly focused on. And you've heard me say, and you'll hear me say today again, that in each of these categories, there are outliers that are not representative of the industry as a whole. And with regard to any outliers, we pay particular attention to why there are outliers and what nuances there are at that institution. And at this point, we feel we're aware of any outlier issues and that they are managing them. They're managing them well, and we are being proactive in supervising them and either putting some constraints around them or making recommendations of what they need to be doing. So with that, I will start with Chart A on page 239. Chart A reflects positive trends in the thrift industry. Capital is in good position. Assets continue to grow through organic means, and also savings banks primarily being the buyer when there's an acquisition involving a savings bank. Overall, the industry is healthy. Over the last four quarters, the median SSB grew by about 3% to $311 million. On Chart B, non-performing assets continue to be low. Profit margin increased slightly in the third quarter and is slightly higher than it was in September of 17. On page 240, Chart C, long-term asset exposure. This is a situation in which there are some outliers that we are paying particular attention to. They have been outliers on long-term asset exposure for many years and have managed well in the past and up at this point. So at this point, we don't consider that to be significant. But as I said, we continue to monitor more closely for them.
So in a rising rate environment, they're going to get squeezed.
That is why we are continuing to monitor them more closely, yes. The fact that they have managed those well so far does not necessarily mean, right. So but we do feel like we're being proactive with them. Mm-hmm. With regard to liquidity, liquidity risk is receiving increased scrutiny as well, particularly as it relates to contingency funding plans. If one or more means of funding for an SSB dries up at some point in the future, don't know that it will or won't, but if it did, we want to see that they have a plan as to what they will do and that they have tested that plan, and the test for that plan has resulted in positive results. Net non-core funding dependence increased in the third quarter due to some growth. And that is, net non-core funding is just one factor that we look at with regard to liquidity. When we monitor liquidity risk, it helps us to determine how much further we need to drill down to make sure that their liquidity is in good shape. We are seeing a five-year high on loans to deposit ratios. The number of loans are growing faster than the deposit base. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, a trend that we're watching closely. And it's too early to tell if it means something particular, but we are staying on top of that. Okay. On page 241, chart E, 92% of state savings banks are rated 1 or 2 with 2 formal enforcement actions. That tells us that the thrift industry is strong. We know that can change, so again, we're monitoring closely and communicating with individual institutions and being proactive with where they stand on isolated issues. Under charter and merger activity, the Spirit of Texas SSB closed November 14th on its acquisition of Comanche National Bank. And then there's a listing of thrift outreach and regulatory meetings are listed. One that's not listed, and I'm not going to every time we meet, but I had told you all a few months ago that we had begun an emerging issues call with the state savings bank presidents and executive teams. We're having monthly calls ongoing. That will be reflected in our mid- and year-end priority report, but they are going very well. The industry feedback is that they are finding the information we give them to be very helpful, and we always get some information from them that is useful to us as well. So that is the thrift report. I'd be happy to answer questions on thrift.
Members, are there any questions?
Okay, then I will move on to page 242 in the mortgage industry. The big thing happening on the mortgage side right now is license renewals. Every mortgage licensee, entity, and individual renews between November 1st and December 31st. As of November 30th, renewals for both individuals and entities were on par with last year. That, you know, we still have another part of this month, and that's of November 30th, so it doesn't include all of December. But at that point, we were on par. So I wanted to let you know what we can tell at this point. At the same time renewals are taking place, we continue to receive new license applications. So as of November 30th, 1,900 new license applications had been received. And the current licensee population is in the materials. There is a slight increase from the year before. On mortgage exams, during first quarter, we did a total of 117 mortgage exams of entities. The number of individual originators involved were smaller because these were smaller examinations of companies, examinations of smaller companies than we had done last year at this point. We've received 219 complaints during the let me back up. On exams, we have not the first quarter exams did not result in any new trends in the examination issues. They continue to be similar to what they were during fiscal year 18. Complaints received 219 during first quarter. In this area, we also saw no new trends at this point. The servicing issues continue to account for the majority of the complaints. And then mortgage departmental operations and industry outreach are listed in the bottom of page 242. And I'd be glad to answer questions about mortgage before we move to legal.
Any questions? Proceed.
Okay. In that case, I will – let me talk about staffing first. I'm sorry. Fiscal, we had one voluntary separation in the first quarter, and that person went to another state agency. You'll see in the materials a listing of the various other postings that we have and where they are in the process. So with that, I will – call on Ernest Garcia to come give the legal report.
Ernest, can I borrow that coat? Because I'm cold up here.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Chairman Plunkett, members of the commission, Ernest Garcia, General Counsel for the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. The legal report is on page 243. We've not had any contested SOA cases since the last Finance Commission meeting. However, we have resolved one case that received some media attention, and that involved Fred Rich down in the Portland and Corpus Christi area. This was a repeat violation situation, or repeat violation of an order, if you will. The agency has received the $100,000 lump sum payment of an administrative penalty already. We anticipate that February we will be getting kind of an audited breakdown of credits that are going to be provided to various consumers, again, primarily in the Portland, Texas area. And then the other piece that isn't discussed here is that relates to de minimis. So as you all may know, the statutory provisions provide that if an individual does five or fewer transactions within the course of a rolling 12 months, they don't have to get a license. And that has been an area of quite a bit of friction between the agency and entities that we believe are engaged in unlicensed activities. And it relates from these individuals getting very creative, in my opinion. So in my personal opinion, they get very creative. They create multiple trusts or multiple limited liability partnerships, and this one will do four, and this one will over here do three, and then they say, none of us exceeded the de minimis. So one of the that was one of the issues in this Fred Rich matter is that you had an individual and numerous affiliated entities, and so one of the things that we provided for in our agreement is that they agree on a going forward basis that if they're going to do any seller financing, that regardless of the statutory de minimis exemptions, that if they do even one, that it'll be done with a licensed originator in place, or there'll be another $550,000 coming due. And that is based on past violations. So that's something that we managed to negotiate in this transaction, and it's in part because they had already violated one order previously with their affiliated entities, and here we are a second time. And so we want to make sure that doesn't happen again.
So this sort of has a look and feel of the Bank Secrecy Act violations where people submit $9,000 in cash to the bank and do it over and over again, thinking they're going to avoid the $10,000 reporting requirements.
Right.
So a question for you is this something we need to address through a rulemaking, or do you think it happens so infrequently that we can do it on a one-off basis?
Well, the problem is it's statutory, and it's not one-off. It happens all the time. We're now, we've yet to have opposing counsel take us all the way to the end and get a decision on it. But we've had numerous counsel that will argue, well, you know, I don't know why you're wasting time with this. Y'all are being, you know, too aggressive. This particular entity might not is not this other entity, and so it didn't exceed the de minimis. But we've been able to work things out through discussions and negotiations. So it's never actually gone to a final decision or to a court, but it has to do with the flavor of, say, piercing the corporate veil that you're familiar with and things of that nature.
Yeah. So to me, you know, one line of reasoning would be we ought to be able to, in some fashion, put this subsegment of the industry on notice about what's permissible behavior and what's not. So I don't know whether that requires a statutory fix or whether it's something we can do a rule interpretation on or do another rule, but it sounds like, you know, if I'm a practitioner, creative structuring is probably something I do in the real estate business. And so if you know that if you're put on notice that that sort of thing's not going to work, it seemed to me that would be useful to the market participants. But I'll leave that up to you.
All right. Appreciate that, Chairman, and we can certainly discuss that internally and maybe visit with other stakeholders as well to see what might be the best way to get that out there. But the other matter that isn't referenced in the legal report, but I thought I would mention it because it's not every day that you deal with spoliation, I don't think, as a lawyer. So we have a case that we thought was going to have concluded in a hearing in prior to this Finance Commission meeting, but it didn't. It's got to spill over into January. And there's already been one hearing before the SOA judge on this matter. I'm not exactly sure which way she's going to go. For those of y'all that may not be familiar with spoliation, That's just a way to kind of talk about a situation where one party to litigation is concerned that maybe the other party or their counsel has been involved in altering evidence. And you see it a lot of times in cases where there's going to be a jury, as opposed to just an ALJ or a fact finder. But even where you just have the judge as the fact finder as well, there could be some impact because spoliation is basically a derivative, if you will, of discovery abuse. And so we are dealing with a case where we believe this individual and his business have been involved in loan modification. And during the course of the discovery process, we felt like certain documents that had been provided to us in the discovery process had been altered. Very hard to see when you're looking at, say, a Xerox copy. And so we pushed the issue and were given an opportunity to see the originals. And these were internal documents only. These were not documents that would be going to any third party. And when we saw the originals, we could see that they had put white correction tape over certain things that would have gone to the terms and conditions of negotiating a loan on behalf of or a refinance on behalf of a customer. And so we feel like that's pretty significant. And there's also evidence there that they would get information from a customer, somebody who was maybe struggling to pay their debt. And they would say, okay, well, we're going to negotiate with your lender on your behalf, so give us some idea of what your income and expenses are. And then what they would do is they would take that particular customer's signature from some other document, cut it, I mean literally cut it, and tape it on this document here, and alter that and send it to the mortgage company. So not every day that SML Legal runs into this type of stuff. In fact, I would submit that it's not every day that most lawyers run into a spoliation issue. So it'll be interesting to see how the ALJ handles it, even though it's, again, no jury. It'll be interesting to see if to what extent they sanction the other side with respect to that. So we should be able to report on at least that aspect of the case. Because we are asking in part for a partial summary disposition based on that abuse. So it'll be interesting to see how the SOA judge handles that. So that's one thing that's not on this particular legal report. Going to the next page, 244, as the other agencies, we are also tracking a variety of bills that have already been pre-filed. Two bills in particular that are referenced here, and they each have companions, so it's more than two. The first one, and they both involve Senator Zaffirini, Senate Bill 37, SB 37, is going to, and that has three companions, House Bill 218, 258, and they're both referenced in the materials, but also House Bill 466 is also an identical companion. But this seeks to eliminate a default on a student loan as a grounds for license denial. But the more significant one is Senate Bill 42. And we talked about de minimis a moment ago, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit more. So Senate Bill 42, filed by Senator Zaffirini, seeks to create a new chapter in the finance code, Chapter 159, to deal with the area of the wraparound mortgage transactions, and to be administered by the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. And one of the things that Senator Zaffirini's office is very sensitive to is that de minimis. As we worked through this, and this is a bill that was filed last session and got just that close, almost passed, but didn't quite at the very last minute. So it's been refiled for this session. But one of the things that we had discussed years back and have continued to discuss with her office, as well as Senator Watson, Senator Rodriguez's office, because they also filed RAP legislation last session, was this issue of the de minimis and the various entities that try to get around it. And so one of the things that this bill proposes is to, among other things, allow the commissioner to decide if these are substantially similar entities, and it would give that statutory authority. So that de minimis is not going to be an obstacle, at least as it relates to wraparound mortgage transactions. That concludes the legal department division report. Happy to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Then, Mr. Chairman, that concludes SML's report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ernest.
Thanks, sir.
Members, I'd direct your attention to the camera at the back of the room, which is on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Accordingly, we're not going to have our executive session in this room. We will leave. And so at this time, it is 10:43 a.m. on December the 14th. 2018, the commission will leave the room and go to a closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 551.071, 551.076, and 551.089 to discuss agenda items number A9, A10, and B3. The commission will return upon conclusion of the closed session meeting. Commissioner Cooper, can we have somebody stay in this room so we can leave our materials here?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, members, and we will be gone for 10 to 20 minutes, depending on how good we are at time. 14th, 2018, and the commission is now back in open session. No action was taken in the closed session. Is there any more business to be...
Mr. Chairman, I have a question or consideration. Is there, would there, again, I realize there's already a schedule out for next year. Would there be consideration for shifting our meetings where we don't have a meeting in December? It's just a short month, both business and personally, and going to make every effort to always be here, but it seems like we're just... It seems like a tough month to have a meeting in. Do you agree?
You know, yeah. The rules require that we meet six times a year, and we've sort of had this pattern for some time. So my preference is to stay on the pattern we are, but I'd be happy to listen to comments from other folks.
I think we probably looked at alternatives in the past, but we can at least kind of go through them again to see if there's anything that, you know, we will not be meeting in January. So
I would just add is that the interval between the meetings is also somewhat important,
right,
because of the comment periods for rules. And this particular meeting, we had moved up a week, I believe, and so one of the rule actions we had, the comment period actually ended on Monday, December 3rd, which is really the day that our materials are due to prepare the book material. So it's pretty tight, and we had to scramble, and we were a day late getting them in because we got a comment that day. So anyway, the interval between is kind of important too.
So if that happened, the time was the same or like it was this year, and we're going to meet in January.
Hmm.
Doesn't work.
We don't meet in January.
Well, no, if we shifted.
But we didn't propose any rules today. Nobody proposed any rules. So it's just when there's rule proposals that it's an issue.
Well, I'm saying instead of us meeting in February, May, or March, we
you
met in January.
March.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, if there's no one has any other concern about them, we'll just go on. There's no reason for further discussion.
We can look at it, see if there's any recommendation.
Let us think about it.
Paul, I just had one other question, not on that topic. With respect to the requirement or the suggested requirement for annual training, given that this is year end, and I realize, of course, you're new in your position, have you given thought to, or has there been discussion about what the members might receive this year to satisfy their potential annual training for 2018, and if we're going to implement anything this year or do that next year?
Stephanie, you want to come up and say what y'all have been working on, and then Leslie and Kara?
Keep your coat on. You can keep it on.
You could wear your coat if you wanted to.
Stephanie Newberg, Texas Department of Aging. I don't think that requirement's actually in effect yet. I think the sunset recommendation is that we have to do it by September of 19. But we have developed the annual program. The three commissioners are looking at it. I think we're probably 90% done. We've also provided it to the chair for him to look at. It's sort of interactive where it gives lots of links to things that you can go look at. One of the things I also thought I would do before we came out with it completely was have the newest members look at it, because it's supposed to be a guide, too, or that was our goal. It's not just some training that you have to sign once a year. Yeah, I remembered all these things. But we were trying to make it be a guide. So if you were at a meeting or, you know, after a meeting, you wonder, like, I didn't really understand why we did it that way or what we did, that it was set up somewhat as a guide where you could go back and look something up. So we are very far along. It's not a requirement yet, but we will have something, you know, probably within the next 2 or 3 months for sure. I don't know if you'll have anything to add on.
Oh, I was just going to say we were working on it. I've got some common suggestions, and we're in the process of working through it, but you covered that.
So. Yeah, it looks really good.
Yeah, and we had some edits as well.
Yeah.
That we sent in to Stephanie, so, but it's very far along.
Okay, thank you. I'd just like to go on record and wish everybody a very Merry Christmas.
I'll second that.
Thank
you. The record will reflect. You wish everybody a Merry Christmas.
Members, is there anything else? Okay, the time is 11:06, and this meeting of the Finance Commission of Texas is adjourned.